Session number 12913.
The Bellows Reel 2.
We were very disappointed because the next thing we were told, we were on our way to Palestine. And that's where we went. We pulled into Haifa and a beautiful day, and looked on the quay and saw these Arab men dressed very colourfully. They looked smashing with their long, looked like long coats that came almost to the ground, their head dresses. After seeing the natives of India, they looked like Rajas. Now, there was a cruiser lying alongside. I think it might have been the Ajax. We watched her guns suddenly turn up onto Mount Carmel, and she opened fire. That was error. Baptism.
How many rounds?
She fired about 6 rounds onto Mount Carmel.
Could you see what kind of a target it was?
All you could see was Mount Carmel in the distance. You could see no, you couldn't see what they were firing at. Then we were told to get ready for disembarkation. And by the way, before I go any further, I will say that I've tried, and everyone's denied the fact that we were bound for the Polish corridor. There's no official records of it. They all say that, officially they still say that we were bound for Palestine. But we were definitely told where we were going. So this is another one of those things that never comes out. I'll mention that. Anyway, to carry on, we were all ready for to disembark, and we looked down on the quay, and there was a line of transport for the whole battalion. And then we had a problem. They sent round, or it came over the tannoy, for volunteers, for drivers. Out of a whole battalion of other ranks, we didn't have one driver. Because this was 1938. No one had ever, they'd all joined up as young men. No one had ever driven cars. Some of these men had been in India for 7 years. So there we were. Transport, no driver. So they had to go around and get volunteer Arab and Jewish drivers to drive our transport. And these men drove until such times as we could get men out from England and train our own drivers. So this was quite unique. We used to use the Arab drivers, even when we had our own, until we were fully mobilised, send them in front. If it was any landmines, it was them that hit them. Rather a dirty trick, but we enjoyed it.
Were any of them blown up?
Only once we had one, had a narrow miss, but we were reassured that they would catch it first. But of course there was the other thing, that there would have been a section of our own men in the car with them. Now, I went into Nazareth, and I was in Battalion HQ there. And one day we had one of the companies had been out and raided a Jewish village, or settlement as they were. And apparently they'd give it a good turnover, because the Jews were just as bad as the Arabs in those days. As a matter of fact, personally, I had a lot of sympathy for the Arabs, because the Jews were better armed than they were, although that was just personal. And the village that they'd raided and turned over, there was a reason for it, because every house or hut that the airmen had gone into had a picture of Hitler. I mean, this was well over 50 years ago, so I don't remember the name of the village now. But there was a sequel to it, because the next day a car pulled outside of their hotel in Nazareth, and there's two Germans in it, the German consul and his assistant. The German consul came in and announced himself. He'd already phoned up and said he was coming, and he was taken up to see the CO. Now the assistant consul parked a car, and then he came up. Now, to go into the hotel, there was like a hall where the regimental policeman stood by the door with a kosh in his hand. And then right in the centre of the hall, there was a stone staircase leading up onto the next landing where the CO's office was. The assistant consul went up these stairs, and they were both for him and the German consul were dressed with breeches, high boots, sort of bush jackets, and sort of hats similar to the bush hats of the Aussies. But this assistant consul went up there, and just as he got to the top of the stairs, the RSM plonked himself right in the middle of the stairs and said, "Where are you going?" And with his accent, he said, "I'm going with my consul." The RSM said, "You're what?" He said, "I am going with my consul." He said, "You're not," he said. He said, "The appointment was for the consul only," he said, "not you," he said. "I'm afraid you'll have to go outside and wait for him in a car." He refused and tried to push past the RSM, who promptly turned him round and kicked him straight down the stairs. He clattered down to the bottom, picked himself up, and he looked rather shattered, obviously. And the RSM shouted down to the regimental policeman. He said, "If he attempts to come up again," he said, "hit him over the head with that kosh." Of course, he went outside. The RSM then turned round to me, because I was stood with a signal in my hand, which I was going to take to the adjutant, and I, plus the regimental policeman, I was the only one that actually saw and heard what had gone on. He said, "If you say anything about this, Bellows," he said, "I'll have your guts for bloody garters." So I didn't. And that's what happened there. So
who was in these houses who had the pictures of Hitler?
Actually, they were Jews, but they were German Jews. And they must have still had a very strong allegiance to Hitler, because every one of them had a picture of Hitler on the wall in a place, in their place of honour. He was there. Now,
it seems surprising that Jews should have had pictures of Hitler.
Not at all. You see, a lot of Jews still thought and held allegiance to Germany. There was a lot of Jews in the army, Jewish officers, the same as in this country. House of Lords is full of them. I mean, Germany was exactly the same. And those people could not accept the fact that they were no longer
acceptable
as Germans. Now, another place I was at was Sarafand. Now, in Sarafand, we had a big camp that was full of refugees that had been captured off of various boats that had tried to land. These refugees came from Germany. Now, I stood by the wire, and there was a really beautiful Jewish girl there. And I started to make conversation with her. I was really attracted to her. And after a while, she said to me, in perfect English, she could speak, I don't know how many languages. I sort of had cultivated her over a couple of days. She said, it's no good. She said, I know what you want, she said, but she said, I must tell you, I'm unclean. I said, she said, as most of the women here are. She said, we had to get out of Germany, and we managed to get hold of an old boat that was crewed by an Indian crew. We had to take all of our own food and water aboard, which we did. But this boat was so old and took so long to get to Palestine that they ran and kept breaking down, that they ran out of food and water. And to get that food from the crew, the women had to sell themselves. And nearly all of them were infected with venereal disease. Now, all of those people were sent back to Germany. I dare say all of them, well, what happened to them? And I often think of this now. We sent them back just to be killed. Now, another little job I had was on a picket. And, actually it was the same picket as I was telling you of before, with a platoon of Irish, RURs, Royal Ulster Rifles. And it was St. Patrick's Day. It must have been St. Patrick's Day 39. As a signaller, I had to send down and order everything they wanted for their St. Patrick's Day celebrations. So every man came to me and gave an order for what they wanted and paid for it. I bought the order and sent a signal down by heliograph to the company headquarters. The next day being St. Patrick's Day, everything arrived. St. Patrick's Day with the Irish. It's fantastic. We had a table laid out down the centre of the picket, and the picket being a stone wall which we'd built, and with a hut in the middle. The stone wall obviously was for defence. For dinner, it was just like a Christmas dinner. Bottles of beer, everything perfect. Then the rations or the supplies that I'd ordered arrived on two camels. But Drabby, our driver, as our leader of the camels, he came up, and as I'd had a couple of pints of beer, I had my rifle across my shoulders, slung over to my back. I went out to meet the camels, because I was the man that was going to issue out the beer. I ordered the Drabby to put the camel down, which he did. I got on the back and drove in, or rode in style, into the camp, singing the desert song. The driver, when we stopped, I didn't see him do it, just tap the knees of the camel, which was its signal to go down. And they go down front first, which that camel did. And I went straight over the top. My rifle come up, hit me in the back of the head, knocked me out. Wasn't out very long. Everybody thought it was a great laugh. Anyway, when I came round, I started issuing out all the beer, cigarettes that had been ordered, chocolate, and to the men as per list. One man, he came up and asked for beer, and I said, "You're not on the list, you never ordered anything." Now, his skin was like a bit of parchment. He immediately started abusing me, but I saw him off. So that evening, I sat round with the rest of the Irishmen there, and they were singing their sentimental songs and crying, because they seemed to always cry when they sang sentimental songs. And I was sitting under a shelter where I had a telephone, the signal equipment underneath. I mean, we didn't have a telephone. And it was just a bit of galvanized, balanced on across some wood. This man who'd refused to drink, or to give him bottles that he hadn't paid for, came up. He was dead drunk. He called me in English. Used the word bastard. Produced the 18-inch bayonet from behind his back and took a swipe at my head. And if it hadn't been for the galvanized, he'd have cut me open like I don't know what. Of course, we immediately jumped on him and tied him down. Now, that man, I said, "Where in the blazes did he get his drink?" And he'd gone to the cookhouse, and the method of cooking then was a petrol burner, which shot out a stream of flame. And there was trays that the flame went through, and the pots went on top. He'd got a pint mug of petrol, a couple of dessert spoonfuls of sugar, mixed it up, and that's how he was drunk. He drank petrol, and they said it was usual for him to do it. Well, at the end of the festivities, everyone got down to it and went to sleep. Next thing I knew, we were being attacked by Arab terrorists. They were firing all around us and throwing in homemade grenades, which was beer cans stuffed with stones, whatever you had, whatever. with an explosive in it and a bit of fuse. Made more noise and damage than caused any damage. Now, the corporal that was in charge, he immediately said, call for assistance, which I did. I signalled down to the HQ, who had already been alerted by the firing, and asked for covering fire. Now, I used the signal lamp, and I was still drunk, I must admit it, and I hadn't put the nightshade on, so that I was using a full lamp, and bullets was coming round me thick and fast. And from below, I could hardly read the signals because the light was too bright. So I came round to what I was doing and put on the filter and filtered the light so that they could read my signals. Now, this is another thing that I think must have been the last time it ever happened. Stationed down below was a detachment of the Royal Navy with their guns, which they'd brought from the Ajax. I believe it was the Ajax. And they gave supporting fire round us using their field guns. Now, I think that must have been the last time that the Royal Navy ever used field guns in action.
Where was this place?
And this was I think it was called Mugdat in Palestine, on top of a hill. And they were in the valley below. The name of the place, I forget. I mean, it was such a long time ago. But the shell fire around us quickly frightened the hell out of the Arabs, and they did a runner. We had no casualties, and we found no casualties outside. But the next day, with my glasses, I did see in the distance going towards Syria quite a large body of Arabs on horses. I signalled this down to HQ, but whether they caught them or not, I don't know. And another thing happened there was I saw a signal coming from a mountain, dickens of a way away, and I answered with my heliograph, and I found out I was in touch with the French Foreign Legion in Syria, and we established contact, and I always remember that. The next time I was to see them was later on in the war.
So although you can't remember the name of the place, it must have been not far from the Syrian border.
It wasn't far from the Syrian border, no. And that must have been definitely the last time that was used. Now, from there, we went into Muasca in Egypt. We went up to El Daba. And when we were in it, so it must have been 1939, because I was at El Daba on an exercise, or outside of El Daba, when war was declared. I took the signal for the declaration of war, as I was a company signaller then. I wish I'd have kept it. Well, I did, but got lost. And within a couple of 3 hours, I was on a railway station between Darba and Alex and took over the telephone exchange. It only had 5 lines, but that was my job. Now, at the time, all the Arabs were being pulled in because it was expected that there would be a war, and all the Bedouins were gathered, or quite a large amount of them were gathered round this little railway station. Can't remember the name of it. And it was the end of the feast of Ramadan. Now, we had quite a nice time there. I had a meal with the station master, all sitting in a circle with a big copper dish, all digging in. No knives and forks, fingers only. And then afterwards, we had a hookah to have a smoke. And I saw him put a piece of like tar on top of the ashes, and I didn't realise it at the time, but it was obviously dope. And after smoking it, I was really high. We went across in the evening, as it was getting on in the evening, we went across to the celebrations where all the Bedouins were celebrating, and all the men were in a big circle, and in the middle was the women. Apparently they were all the unmarried women. And they were all dancing and singing. And the men were armed with their rifles. Their rifles were exactly as you see on the pictures of the old Arabs. Rifles about 5'6" long, bound with brass, tin, anything you like. And they were all muzzle loaders. And, well, they wouldn't have hit a barn at 60 yards, I shouldn't think. Well, while we were watching this, I was in the front. I'd been pushed there by the station master, who I'd become friendly with. And one of the girls stopped in front of me. And she was dancing and waving. And she was singing. The song went like, "One a many hin, ha, one a many hin, ha." That seemed to be the words she was singing. I said, "What's she doing?" He said, "This is the dance of the broads. You've got to, she's picked you and you've got to marry her." Of course, I was full of dope. And I just took off across the desert, and a big crowd of these Bedouins all chased me shouting and firing their rifles in the air.
You mean you were running away?
I was running away. And of course I didn't realise it, but this station master had set me up.